This is Risa Mednick for Women at Work. Today we'll be speaking with Saad Ajani, the Program Coordinator for the Middle East and Horn of Africa for Grassroots International. Welcome, Saad.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the work of Grassroots International and about your background, where you come from, and what motivates the work that you do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Grassroots International is a human rights and development organization. It was established in 1983, and we raise funds for local civic organizations in different parts of the world, including Palestine, Eritrea, Brazil, Haiti, Mexico, and about a year ago, East Timor. So we have programs in six countries. I myself come to this work after having been a university or a college professor for a long time, and a sense that I want to have more of an immediate impact. I want to feel that I'm doing something that seems to have results a bit quicker. So I joined Grassroots International about a year and a half ago. I am originally Palestinian myself, and my current job allows me to work on Palestine and Eritrea. So that's part of, yeah.
We're meeting in the midst of an ongoing crisis in the Middle East with a dramatic increase in the past month or 2 months in violence between Palestinians and Israelis. And I know that your work focuses intensely on that region, and I'm wondering if you could give us a briefing on what's going on in the region, who you and your colleagues are partnering with in Palestine, and a women's perspective on the conflict.
All right, let me try to do this in a concise way and not get into a long story here. Let's see. The current crisis today seems to be a result of the failure of the Oslo process, which for many people who had read the Oslo documents, the peace process that was begun in 1993 when Rabin and Arafat and Clinton signed this agreement on the White House lawn, that launched the most recent peace process in the Middle East. And for those who read the documents could see that its failure was really built into that, but a lot of people were hoping for the best and didn't want to see the writing on the wall. But the violence today is really a direct outcome of the flaws that were built into this process right from the start that do not give justice and meet the national rights of the Palestinians, or even the human and national rights of the Palestinian people. So while there has been talk of peace for the last 7 years in the media and the public discourse and so on the ground in the occupied territories, you were seeing measures taken by Israel to do anything but lead to a just peace. I have been in the area 3 times over the last year and a half, and every time I go, I've really been struck by the way Israel has been using the peace process to build facts on the ground. In other words, expand the settlements, take Palestinian agricultural land and other lands to carve out these huge roads that are meant mainly for settlers, Jewish settlers, keep the closure on Palestinian areas so that Palestinians can't move freely, create this situation where the areas under Palestinian control, which until today the areas of self-rule are only 17.2% of West Bank and about 80% of Gaza, but create these enclaves really that are very isolated from each other, separated by areas of exclusive Jewish control and so on, and creating the conditions for an emerging apartheid in these areas. So over the last 7 years, contrary to trying to use this process to fulfill various international laws that were there over 52 years that haven't been implemented, the peace process has been really misused to Israel's advantage. In the last round of negotiations before all this, which was in July of 2000, the media told us that Jerusalem and the refugees were really sticking points. And in fact, that's partly true. In other words, Israel has never been willing to give East Jerusalem, which is occupied territory, back to the Palestinians. And they've never been willing to even acknowledge their role in the creation of the refugee problem in 1948, which is when more than three quarters of the population of Palestine, the Palestinians, were kicked out, including my own parents. So the peace process was never really meant to address these core issues of the Palestinian problem or issue. And a lot of these things were on hold for the last several years, and now that they have to face up to reality and face to the crunch, Israel has been unwilling to meet its obligations. So those were really, this is very, very brief about the current conflict. People's frustration and demoralization and dissatisfaction was just rising over the last 7 years, and you could see that each time you go there, just feeling they talk peace, but they do something else on the ground. And each time I've been there, I've been able to see how people have become very disillusioned and felt betrayed both by the international community, especially the U.S., which has sided so totally with Israel, by Israel, and even by their own leadership in the West Bank and Gaza. The groups that we work with, we support 8 organizations there, some of them being in Gaza and some being in the West Bank, and some of which have branches, let's say have a main office in the West Bank and then have a branch in Gaza. And it's really interesting that given under this wonderful peace process, people can't even travel to meet each other. So they're totally isolated offices, you know, in each of these enclaves. We support, I'll name them and say what they do, but they sort of, you can see a pattern around those who work on women's issues or food security and agriculture or human rights or medical or so on. So in the West Bank, we have one organization we support is the Democracy Workers' Rights Center, which works on women workers' rights. The Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees, which does work around trying to ensure food security, protect agricultural land, deal with water resources. And one kind of project that we support is a women's clubs in the Jericho area, which is near the Dead Sea, that tries to empower and raise the productivity of local women in that area, in agricultural work, in crafts, in economic self-sufficiency. We support in the West Bank the one of the women's groups is the Women's Center for Legal Aid and Counseling, which does wonderful work on trying to promote women's rights within the context of any emerging constitution in Palestine for the Palestinians. It tries to protect the rights of women who are subject to violence, you know, protecting women, their legal rights, raising awareness, and so on. It's interesting that their office is right at that juncture between the West Bank and Jerusalem, right there where there is a checkpoint. So, you know, you walk downstairs and you're right there. And I guess for the time being, at least now, with this uprising, cars can't pass, you know, that have Palestinian license plates.
So what are the physical realities of your colleagues getting to work every day?
Well, in this particular situation, it's really interesting that the director lives across the street, but it's because of the way the West Bank is carved up, her office is in an area, I believe it's Area B, which is under Palestinian civilian control and Israeli security control, but her home, even though it's right across the street, is in Area C, which is under exclusive Israeli control. She happens to have a Jerusalem permit, so she can get around. She has a staff member who lives, I believe, in Beit Jala, which is, you may have heard in the news, under constant Israeli attacks. The woman used to be able, she's a social worker, she used to be able to get through by herself, but her car couldn't come. You know, they have all these rules and regulations. And some staff members, obviously, you know, would have different degrees of trouble getting through. But this is a constant issue with many of our partners. We call them partners, the groups that we support in these areas. Also, just to run down the groups that we support, there's the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committees that has an office right inside the area of Jerusalem. But the project that we support is a clinic in Gaza. And so here's where there is this sort of disconnect that people can't travel back and forth. We also support in the West Bank the Ibda Cultural Center, which is a community center for refugee youth in Tehesha refugee camp, which is in Bethlehem area. And they do wonderful, wonderful work empowering refugee kids, having activities for them. In fact, people might know, or maybe not, but there was a dance troupe that came through the U.S. last year but didn't get to Boston, and it went to many major cities around the country. They've really created their own dance troupe of kids between, I don't know, 11 and 17 years old, who've created their own dances that are really more Palestinian dances to raise awareness of the refugee issue. The center does wonderful work trying to break the confines of the refugee camp and create a link between the kids there and their counterparts in other places, mm-hmm. in Lebanon, let's say. So they have an internet project which is housed in the camp where kids can log on to the email and communicate with kids in Shatila camp in Lebanon, for example. And that way they're recreating a new identity of a Palestinian that is beyond being a refugee or beyond being even confined in the Palestinian-controlled areas. But the Palestinian identity is being recreated, and this awareness of we are more than just the West Bank and Gaza. We really are, you know, going back to our towns and villages that were destroyed after 1948. And a lot of people are descendants of people who were kicked out and their villages destroyed. In fact, when we were there, we took a delegation, grassroots took a delegation in September, and we visited some of the demolished villages with the kids. And the kids would point out, well, there's my grandmother's house, and, you know, there's nothing there now. It's rubble, but you can see stones or stairs or fruit trees, and you know that this was a community. And talking about the need to return and the right to return. We also support in the Gaza Strip the Palestine Center for Human Rights, which is a huge organization that works on human rights and tries to lobby and advocate the national rights of the Palestinian people and the human and social rights of the Palestinian people, and has done a lot of work with trying to intercede with the UN, United Nations Human Rights Commission, and other UN and other international agencies. And we support their legal work and their human rights work. We support the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. They have a clinic called the Jabalia Clinic. They do a lot of work. What we support is the Jabalia Clinic, which addresses the needs of victims of torture, whether it be in Palestinian jails or, you know, through the occupation. And right now, we've received so many statements and appeals from them, as from all the organizations we support, about the conditions under this uprising, and especially in Gaza, which is really closed off. What I understand now is that people can't enter or leave. But one of the things we're also hearing is just the trauma, the traumatized population, the kids who have nightmares, you know, the women who see their husbands and brothers and kids shot and killed, and just the level of traumatization increasing and the need that is emerging from that. We also support in Gaza another women's organization, which is the Women's Affairs Center, that does a lot of work, again, in raising awareness around issues to do with women, women's rights. But what we support or have been supporting is what they call the development clinic, which is trying to bring women who want to start their own businesses and train them in what how to do that, how to go apply for bank loans, what you need to know, what kinds of resources are available out there. And in fact, when we were there again during our delegation in September, we visited two shops that were opened by women who had taken those trainings, where they sell crafts, embroidery, and so on, are really proud of that kind of work. So those are the organizations that we support, and two of them are obviously exclusively women, but the rest of them to some degree or another obviously address women's issues. There is a sense, because women during really emerged on the scene, at least more publicly, during the uprising, the first uprising, which was in the late 80s, when they were right there at the forefront of the struggle, at the right in the middle of the struggle, throwing stones, doing the kind of work to protect the Palestinian community, alternative teaching, alternative agriculture, so as not to depend on Israel and show their rejection of Israel. In this latest intifada, what has been going on since 28th of September, women have seemed to be less on the front lines, and therefore, in some ways, it seems less empowered and more vulnerable. The whole nature of this confrontation has been different than the one of 12 years ago, in that there's been less of direct confrontation, throwing stones at Israeli soldiers, although there's been some of it, but there it seems to be almost a one-way war against the Palestinian people, throwing bombs and missiles from helicopter gunships, firing anti-tank missiles, snipers, and so on. So the military violence seems to be much more intense on the Israeli side, and the Palestinians have had really just to be endure this, and they've been more as victims of this and less direct confrontations of the type that had existed before, in part because of what happened during Oslo. And everything that I'm hearing from the groups that we support as well as other people is about, well, on the one hand, that everybody wants this intifada to continue because they feel that unless Israel withdraws completely from the areas it occupied in 1967, according to international law, then there will not be any just peace. And they got fed up with this pretense called Oslo that really was an excuse for Israel to continue taking more. And so the whole population seems to be behind it, but the victimization that is going on, loss of life, severe injuries, I don't know whether people know statistics, but there are over 280 Palestinians who've been killed and close to 10,000 who've been injured. One third of them have been children. So this idea that the Israeli soldiers only shoot when their lives are in danger is really a big lie. They've shot kids on their way to school. They've shot people in their homes. They've, shot workers and farmers. It's not all been in these confrontations. And a lot of the injuries are pretty severe. And everything that I'm seeing and hearing is about not only the traumatization that comes with physical injury or death and losing a family member and that kind of, how people are trying to cope with that, but the consequences and suffering that comes with the blockade that Israel has imposed over whole communities. For example, in Hebron, there was a 24-hour curfew for almost the last, whatever it's been, 2 months and something. I just heard recently that it's been lifted for a few hours. But if you can imagine, Palestinians have big families. They're cooped up in their homes. They can't go out to buy food. There's unemployment anyway because, nobody can get to their jobs. And you have all these families cramped in small homes with the threat of shelling from helicopter or tank or so on. So it puts a lot of pressure on whole families, but especially the women who try to keep, heart and soul together, feed the children, care for them, care for their families and so on. And so that's been really, really hard on the women, especially. Women have also lost their own means of livelihood because they can't get to their jobs. Sometimes they used to do subcontracting work, which they can't do right now. They used to work in the informal sector. You know, you could see them, let's say, taking their cart of vegetables, sitting right outside the old city in Jerusalem, and sell squash or thyme or something, which they can't do now. So the men have lost their means of income, the women have. I'm hearing stories right now of hunger, which in the West Bank and Gaza, it's even in the worst days of the last Intifada, it didn't happen. I'm hearing stories of whole families that I think the poverty rate is over 40% right now, and the unemployment rate is close to 60% if you take into account all sectors. Gaza, for example, is, for a while we were hearing news, and it may still be true, of food and fuel being in shortage. Nobody can get in, nobody can get out, and communities are cut from each other. So the suffering is absolutely incredible and unknown. I think it's fallen from the media here, probably because we have to keep talking about Florida and who's going to become president. But in a sense, you know, then when they report it, it becomes just like a footnote. And they may say one or two were killed today, but you don't really get the details. You get a lot of it on the internet, and then you realize that, yeah, one or two in reality means five or six. And for every one who's killed, 10 are injured. And this, and then, you know, just the news that comes in, the collateral damage, if you like. The buildings that were shelled, the roads that were cut, the agricultural land that was destroyed. People can't go to harvest their olives, things like that. It's absolutely mind-boggling what's going on today.
It sounds in many ways like there's almost a shift from a Western perspective in how we think about human rights as well. That we tend to think about human rights in very broad terms, but when we start to think about human rights not only in terms of physical well-being, but also in terms of economic access and ability to simply access the everyday necessities of life, mm-hmm. food, water, ability to get to a job, mm-hmm. all of these things that are in place in this community ordinarily that have been taken away, it seems to put a very different spin on how we construe a war zone, actually, and how we construe suffering. Mm-hmm. And we're not seeing this perspective here in the U.S., are we?
Mm-hmm. We're not. I think that in many parts of the world, and Palestine isn't unique to this, the definition of human rights is different from the U.S. Mm-hmm. Here we really seem to focus it on the individual. And in many other parts of the world, you're talking about collective rights. And this is obviously the case in Palestine because people are not targeted as individuals or denied these rights as individuals. They're denied it as Palestinians. I mean, that's really clear. And even the groups that we deal with, for example, Gaza Community Mental Health Program, always talks about the mental health as being a human right and associated with human rights. The more traumatized these people are, you're talking about the wholesale violation of the rights of the people that leave them traumatized. So this is the case with, I mean, the same thing with women. You're talking about the rights of women being more than just the right to a job or the right to abortion or the right to better pay as we have it here. You're talking about them as being able to be secure as women and as Palestinians. You can't walk out of your own skin and say, okay, today I'm a woman, tomorrow I'm a Palestinian, and sort of divide up your rights that way. It doesn't work. Same thing for being, you know, the children and so on. And yeah, there is a total violation of all, probably every international resolution or treaty or convention that deals with these things, social and economic rights and human rights and national rights. I mean, Israel has violated virtually everyone in the book, if not all of them, and refuses to acknowledge that, for example, the provisions of the Fourth Geneva Convention that talk about protection of civilians in time of war. It refuses to acknowledge it's an occupying power, and therefore these things supposedly don't apply here. So we're talking about something which is, it's so unknown and remote at so many levels here in the U.S. It's very difficult to begin even knowing where to start to explain what's going on. And I think part of the problem here is that there's this hostility to anything Palestinian anyway, because of the strong pro-Israel stand of the government, and because of the pro-Israel stance of the mainstream media as well. And so there's a bias to trying to introduce what the issues are. And obviously Israel is trying to counter the Palestinian voice in all of this. So for example, here we've heard so much about Arafat is in control of the violence. He could switch it off just like he switched it on. And people don't understand that this isn't Arafat. He may have allowed this to start at the beginning for political reasons, basically to show Israel that Palestinians are not happy with the deal that Israel was presenting. But it really isn't him. It's the pent-up, built-up frustration of at least 7 years, but also count 33 years of occupation, where Palestinians have been denied their rights and told that they must continuously compromise. This is the big word here, that catchphrase, compromise. And they see everything being taken away, and yet they're still being expected to compromise. They see that they're being now, the language is that, oh, Palestinians are sending their kids to be shot. Who in the world as a parent would want to see their children die? I can't understand this obscenity, this racism, that people can even allow themselves to say such a thing is totally flabbergasting. If you go to those areas and you see what conditions people are under, whether it's a kid in a refugee camp or somebody living in other privileged conditions, you know that you're under occupation. And people have a right to resist occupation. And when a soldier or a settler could come, walk in your land, take over your home, demolish your home, prevent you from moving, prevent you from seeing your grandparents, not allow you to go back to your original village, not allow your dad to work, not allow your mom access to a hospital. A kid doesn't need Arafat or anybody else to say, I want to get rid of this thing that is not allowing me to be just like an Israeli Jewish child. Why should they have peace and security? Why can they have water? Why can they travel when they want to? Why can they have swimming pools in their gardens? Why can they come and settle on my land, and I am supposed to just swallow this and say, yes, we must compromise? I mean, people over here don't realize that in 1948, Israel took over 78% of what used to be Palestine, which is now Israel. And Palestinians entered into a peace process to try to recover 22% that were remaining, the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Over this peace process, Israel has taken control, still has exclusive control of over more than 60% of the West Bank and 20% of Gaza, has kept on introducing its settlers into all these areas. Even under this intifada, there have been about 5 or 6 settlement starts that I've read about, and that leaves out the ones that I don't know. And it's not clear, how much are Palestinians supposed to compromise on a compromise of a compromise? And that's still that kind of word that is thrown around, that Arafat has not given enough. Enough of what? We've given up our homeland. Now they want us to give up our right to return. They want us to give up our right to East Jerusalem. They want us to agree to the permanence of settlers and settlements in the West Bank. And by the way, these settlers and settlements are among the most fanatic that you'll ever find. And they're on the rampage right now in the West Bank and Gaza too. And we still haven't done enough. This assumption about what Palestinians are supposed to endure and what they're supposed to do in this process is just amazing. So the whole population is in this together, and yeah, it's a war, but it's a war against the Palestinian people here.